Leslie Cohen is here to talk about the legendary club Sahara and give us her spin on our LGBTQ issues. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Charlotte. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Tell us about the legendary lesbian nightclub Sahara in New York City.
Well, Sahara was opened in 1976. And it was opened by four women, very close friends, including myself, Linda Goldfarb, Barbara Russo, and Michelle Floria. We were very good friends. Michelle and I were partners, and Linda and Barbara were partners, romantic partners. And I went to graduate school with Barbara, and Linda and Michelle grew up together on Long Island. But we were like, you know, the four musketeers would go to clubs together, and these clubs were just kind of like divey, mafia-owned, you know, holes in the wall. They kind of like were, you know, the continuation of the 1950s and 1960s mentality. Very repressed and very taboo when being a lesbian or being a gay man was very considered perverse and sick. And that was reflected in the clubs. And it was kind of like, again, mafia-owned, so they really had no connection other than to make money. And they were mafia-owned because, for the most part, they were illegal for many, many years. And people would get arrested, and you'd have, you know, like we all know with Stonewall, you know, they'd be busted and all that. And that was kind of the atmosphere that I grew up in. I mean, the idea of being a lesbian was so taboo that it was nothing on TV. There was nothing in the media. And it was just like you were the sin and you were sick. So that's how we grew up. But, you know, when I realized I was gay, I didn't feel shame. I felt joy. I felt joy that I realized who I was. And I just didn't buy into the whole perverse scenario. I knew I wasn't perverse. I knew I was a good person. I knew that love was love. And why would somebody label it as something that was wrong or negative? So that was the attitude that we had going to these clubs. You know, we just didn't get it. And at the time, you know, you'd always hear people say, God, why doesn't somebody open something for women that's, you know, that's nice, that's, you know, elegant, that's timely, and blah, blah, blah. And so it turned out that Michelle and I started to talk about this, opening a club. And I was, at that time, I was a art historian. I was curator of a major New York museum, had a very, very impressive job, meeting a lot of very famous artists and people. And Michelle was representing commercial film directors. But we somehow, you know, the museum was closing for lack of finances, and Michelle got onto this, and she just said, all right, I'm doing it. And Michelle is just a gangbuster. Nothing holds her back. So our two friends, when they heard about this, said, oh, good, we want to do this with you. Oh, okay. And Linda said, and my father will back it. Oh, all right, fine, you're our partners. We had no money. So anyway, long story short, we ended up, after a lot of wrong turns, opening this club. And the fact is, we were so naive that we didn't realize what we were doing. We didn't realize that the whole club thing was mafia-controlled. We were very naive. I mean, none of us had any experience in the club business. But, you know, I came to it with these grandiose ideas of, you know, having been an art historian and reading about these fabulous lesbians in the early 20th century Paris and London and all this. You know, I said, to me, lesbians were fabulous and some of the most accomplished women in a time when it was so hard for women to get any recognition ended up being lesbians. As I read about them, I found out they were lesbians, and they were role models for me, and I wanted to recreate that in New York. I thought that the time was right. It was the beginning of the gay rights movement. It was the beginning of the second wave of feminism, and I thought that it's long overdue that there was a place for women to feel proud of who they were and to showcase their talent. I wanted visibility. I wanted lesbians to become known as something other than this perverse subsect of society, but rather as a driving force of new ideas and creativity. And that's what we incorporated into Sahara. We opened and we made a beautiful, elegant club. And coming from the art world, I was hanging art by women who weren't getting the opportunity to exhibit their work in the gallery scene. Well, very, very little. I mean, if they had any. And we had the Helen Frankenthalers. Most people had some, but for the most part, many, many women were just shut out. So we hung the art. And then the art was now in the, you know, Museum of Modern Art and Guggenheim, but at that time, these women had no attention. That was an aspect that we brought to a dance club. You know, this was sex, rock and roll, and drugs at the time, and it was also something other than a club. It was a cultural and political gathering place. It became ground zero for the political activities of that time. So we had fundraisers for women running for office, like Carol Bellamy and Bella Abzug and Elaine Noble. And all the people who wanted to show their support for the gay rights and the women's movement came to this club to support us. So it was very, very heady stuff. I mean, I could tell you all the names of the famous people that came, but there were many, you know, and all the leaders of the women's movement and the gay rights movement, you know, from Gloria Steinem to Betty Friedan to Patti Smith to Jane Fonda to Pat Benatar, who was like our house singer because I started a live music night on Thursday nights, and Pat performed there more than anybody else. So it was very, very heady stuff, and that's what happened.
So how did the club physically come together?
Well, what happened was, so Michelle quit her job and started looking for spaces. And, you know, we went through a lot of different ramifications. I mean, Linda's father ended up not doing it, and then he recommended two guys. These guys turned out to be, you know, we wasted a lot of time with people because we didn't have any money. And finally, they backed out when Michelle found a space. We went to a meeting with the present owner of that space, who was a guy who owned an Indian restaurant there that had burned out. There was a fire there. And this was 1234 Second Avenue. And when we went there, we had the two guys that already backed out, so we had nothing. So Michelle pulled like a rabbit out of her hat and said, listen, why don't you be our partner and we'll split a 50-50 and blah, blah, blah. And he said, okay, because he had nothing. He had a burned out space and no business, and we had nothing. we didn't have a dime to our name. But long story short, we ended up getting the space. We had a very good lawyer named Sid Davidoff, who was very influential when Dingus was mayor. And he just really helped us tremendously. And we ended up having to get loans from a bank, which, if you remember, at that time was nearly impossible for women, because they had no credit. Before that time, you had to have your husband sign to get a credit card. I mean, it was just a very different time, and women were not appreciated or thought of as businesswomen. And here we were, four young kids, basically, in our late 20s, trying to get loans. So what ended up happening is we had to all get a co-signer to do this, and everybody was able to get one. Linda and Barbara had her father. He co-signed their loan. And we each had to come up with $6,000, which back then was like a fortune to me, to any of us. We had, you know, again, I had no money. And then Michelle had a new lover who had a house. So she had an asset, and she co-signed the loan for Michelle. That was became our Judith Mawson, who was a silent partner, who invested another $6,000. And then I was the only one left, and I couldn't find anybody. I had nobody in my family with money, nobody. My mother had $1,000 to her name, and she gave that to me. So what ended up happening is I was dating somebody, Carol Lee Shepherd's name, still my very close friend. And I told her my problem, and she said, I'll close down the loan for you. And that was it. So we had $30,000, and then we had another $6,000 that our vending machine company that we were going to put in a jukebox at that time and a pinball machine and a cigarette machine. They lent us $6,000 against the proceeds of the vending machine. And that's how we came up with $36,000. And on that amount of money, we built the club. Barbara Russo had a lot of family that was in construction, so they were really instrumental in doing us a favor in putting the club together. And Sid worked for nothing, our attorney. So he would say, how am I going to get paid? But eventually, of course, we were able to carry that. So that's how it happened. It was a struggle all the way through. And I was always in my mind going back into the art world. You know, I was conceptualizing it as a club for women, you know, and conceptualizing it in that salon way. But in my mind, I was going to go back to getting a job in the art world. But I got so involved so quickly between creating Thursday nights at Sahara and the live music and the political activity and the art, which was my responsibility. I curated the museum. I curated the club as if it was a museum. So that's how it happened.
So what was the reign of the Sahara?
Sahara was open from 1976 to December, really, let's say, the new year of 1980. I mean, it literally was closed before Christmas Eve of 1979.
Well, there's never been anything like it since anywhere.
Yeah, well, you know, it was the timing. It was, you know, the right place at the right time. It was so necessary. It had never been done. Like I said, women were always saying, why can't women do this? Why can't? And nobody did it. Again, we did it because we were young and naive, and we had each other, you know? We had the four of us to bolster our confidence, to push each other forward. You know, it was a miracle back then. I mean, when we went to the State Liquor Authority for our liquor license, I mean, they wanted to know if we were moles, covers for the mafia, you know, or if we were hookers. Because who were we coming along to do open a club? Now, of course, we didn't tell them it was a gay club. It was hard enough that we were four women. But if we told them that it was a gay club, we would probably never have gotten that liquor license. Because they would have found some reason to give us a hard time. Because, I mean, it was only a couple of years before that. You know, Stonewall was 69, Sahara was 76, and we started putting it together in 75. So it wasn't only years. And even then, there were still raids on clubs. And there was still, you know, the concept of you could be arrested if you appeared to be morally or I forget the terms they used, but it was a wide open door to arrest somebody. You know, I mean, not that long before, you know, women had to wear three things that showed they were girls. I mean, it was so many crazy ways to prohibit gay clubs from existing. You know, so if there was any kind of what they consider immoral behavior, and that by that it would mean dancing together or holding hands or kissing, you know, they could refuse you a liquor license. So we were not going to tell them we were going to open a lesbian club. And frankly, for me at that time, I conceived of it more as a women's club, even though I knew that the majority of people coming would be lesbians because they'd want to meet other women. It was a women's club, and that's why we had people like Gloria and Betty Friedan and, you know, Patti Smith and Pat Benatar there performing. I mean, you know, it was wide open for that. I just, I wanted to empower women and make them more visible.
Tell us how you and your partner became the models for the George Siegel sculpture, Gay Liberation in Greenwich Village, that commemorates the Stonewall Uprising.
That's an interesting thing, and I really thought in a way it was like kismet, because I was approached while Sahara was open by an old friend of mine named David Boyce, and I had met David when I was an art historian. I was working at Art Forum magazine, and David lived in a loft on Canal Street with his then partner, Manuel, and this was all very sophisticated to me. I was a middle-class Jewish girl from Queens. You know, I just didn't know from the highbrow New York art scene. So this was all very eye-opening and a little bit overwhelming. But I was invited to their loft with a friend of mine who was a graduate student with me at Queens College. And I was totally bowled over. I mean, this was before there were lost living. You know, this was in 1970, 71. And it's like, what the heck are they doing there? They throw a key down and enter this freight elevator. And they lived in the same building as Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns when they were lovers. It was all very hot. So I loved it. So I met these guys, and we ended up becoming friends, and we hung out. And then, of course, I opened Sahara. I left the art world, and I kind of left all those people behind. And Manuel and David, when I met them, Manuel worked at Sidney Drum's gallery. David was an artist. And Manuel would have all these people over for dinner, famous people, you know, from artists and things for dinner. And so when Manuel left the job and David and him, they split up, David moved into the position at Sidney Jones Gallery. Sidney Jones Gallery was a top gallery in New York, and it represented some of the top artists at the time, like James Rosenquist and, you know, a lot of the pop artists, including George Siegel, who was the sculptor of the gay liberation piece. And he called me at the club. He said, "Leslie, I've been asked by George Siegel to find models for a sculpture that's being proposed to go into New York in the village called Gay Liberation. I'm having a lot of trouble finding people because people are frightened to be out. And I thought of you, and you'd be perfect." You know, and I said, "David, you know," and of course, I had outed myself in a very, very big way by opening Sahara. I mean, there was no going back. And at that time, you know, the closet was a very big place in the world, you know. So I was perfect for that, you know, and I was honored, you know. And then I had fallen in love a couple of years before with this woman, Beth. We were mad for each other. And I said, "David, you know, George Siegel wants to capture something. He should use both myself and Beth." He had already asked somebody else who was a mutual friend of ours back from the Loft days, who was a professor at Columbia. And she was very uptight about doing it. So she gladly backed out, you know. So that's how it happened. We became a model. And maybe 2 or 3 weeks before Sahara closed, we didn't know Sahara was closing, which was a shock. We went up to George Siegel's studio in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which was a converted chicken farm. So he had taken the chicken pen and converted that into his studio. And so we went up there and we sat with him and did different poses and, you know, did all kinds of, you know, and talked. And then we went back and he had chosen a pose, and then he plastered us, which was his technique, was, you know, you take these like orthopedic bandages and soak them in water, like you would do a cast on your arm. And he put it all over our body in three sections, from the waist down, then the midsection, and then our head. And we were enclosed into this hardening plastic and then cut out. And that was it. That was 1979, the end of December, I think, just before Sahara closed. And then it took another 13 years for us to finally get into the park because there was a lot of controversy. So that's how it happened. And then I had gone to law school in 1989 and graduated in 92. And 3 weeks, I'd been hired by a law firm in Miami, and I was at NYU. And then 3 weeks before we were scheduled to move, I got a phone call saying that the sculpture was finally going to be unveiled in the park the next day. And that was 13 years later in 1992. And we went with my mother to the unveiling. It was fabulous. It was wonderful. Whenever we go there, there were people from all over the world, tour buses even stopping to see this sculpture. So it's really been an incredible experience for us and an incredible honor. And it encompasses everything that matters to me. You know, it encompasses love between two women. It encompasses art, which to me is the next thing closest to God. And it encompasses the visibility that I always wanted for gay and lesbian people.
When did the sculpture become a national monument?
This is a great story, Charlotte. This was 2016. Beth and I, we were invited to ride on the float for the Gay Pride Parade. And we were in Miami, and, you know, the expense of flying up. But then Pulse happened, the Pulse nightclub massacre. And I was so upset and so disgusted and so freaked out by that that I said, all right, come on, let's go. I really want to be in the parade. And so we were on the first float, ended up in the leading float with the Pulse nightclub owner and staff. So we were going to meet my friend Elaine, who was working on a documentary on us, and we were going to meet her, and she lived in the Village. So, of course, we were going through the park and always stopped to see the sculpture because it's just fascinating to us to sit there and watch people interact with the sculpture, looking at ourselves in a sense, you know. And we're going through and we see people with, you know, these hats on, the national park people, like the Smokey, the bear hats, you know, from the national park. And we said, what's going on? And they said, oh, didn't you hear? President Obama, 20 minutes ago, declared this a national monument. The whole Stonewall Inn, the sculpture, and the surrounding area, a national monument. We said, what? You're kidding. We were like, oh, it's so taken aback. And we said, but you're not going to believe this. We were the models for the sculpture. Well, you know, then they went crazy. And they said, oh, my God, you're kidding. And the photos. And then, you know, people found out. And so there was cameras there because it was just declared a national monument. So we were interviewed on television. It became a whole thing. And we went to the next day to the celebration. And it became the first national monument to gay and lesbian people. So it was really pure fluke, a pure, like, happenstance that we happened to be going through the park at that moment, and we're in, even in New York. And that's how we found out.
With the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, what does that mean to you?
First of all, I think it's a real celebration of how far we've come. And it's also a reminder of how precarious the rights that we have achieved has become under Trump, who is constantly chipping away at everything that we have fought for over the last 50 years. So this reminder is very, very important now to remind people and to educate young people about how difficult it was and how much everybody had to fight for what we now have. I know the New York Historical Society, because I've been working with them, is putting on a major exhibition for Stonewall 50, and I really would encourage people to go. It's going to have a section on Sahara, which makes me very happy, because it's so important to know our history and to make sure that our history is recorded and to continue pressuring for equal rights for ourselves, and not only for ourselves now, but for trans people who were, you know, so instrumental in the Stonewall and in the early gay rights movement, because they were courageous and brave. And this is just a reminder. It's an important celebration. We should be very, very proud, but we should also be very vigilant, because these rights can be taken away. And it's important to stay visible, and it's important to be out there. You know, write your books, tell your stories, make sure that we are part of history and that people can refer to it, and especially for young people. You know, this is so important for young people to see that there are many, many gay and lesbians who fought for their rights and have found joy and happiness in being gay. I'm happy being a lesbian. I've had a lot of joy and a lot of fun, and I want young people to know that. I have found love. I've been with my now wife for 42 years, and it's possible. You will find happiness. You know, I want young people to know that, who don't have that knowledge, that it's important to have a history so that they know.
Do you have a favorite quote, a mantra, to get you through difficult times?
Yeah, you know, my mother would always say this to me, and I've always used it: this too shall pass. It means that it's not the end of the world. You know, there's a bigger picture. You will survive this catastrophe, this loss, this horrible, horrible experience, which, for instance, I had when Sahara was taken away from us illegally by a greedy landlord who bought the property. You know, typical stuff. This too shall pass. I got back on my feet. I created the idea for promoting other clubs for women, and life went on. So this too shall pass.